That is indeed the title. And this talk will be based on work that I did with Andy Knightsky. There's a paper online. You can find many more details there. So the context of my talk will be 4D n equals 2 quantum field theories. And we're going to study BPS line defects. In these theories. And these you can physically think of as some heavy source particles. And so in the first half of my talk, I'll review some basic properties of these kind of defects and what questions are physically natural to ask about them. And in the second half of the talk, I'll get to more of the meat of this work where we discuss a kind of new way to compute these features. OK. So these BPS line defects, let's see. OK, so BPS line defects, we'll define them by symmetries that they preserve. So we want them to preserve an SO3 rotation symmetry. We want them to preserve the SU2R symmetry. We're in 4D n equals 2, so we have an SU2R. This will be useful later because we're going to be studying these defects on the Coulomb branch of the theory, where the SU2R is again preserved. So we want to keep this property. They're BPS, so they're going to preserve half of the supersymmetries. And the fact that they're line defects, we're going to have them preserve time translation but no other translations. OK, so what's the basic example? The basic example is the Wilson line in Super Yang Mills. So what does that look like? Well, I've got a path-ordered exponential in some representation R. I'm integrating along the time axis because I want to preserve time translation to give it the interpretation of a heavy source particle. So here I'll put the connection. And if I were not talking about BPS particles, I would just stop and close all these parentheses. But since I'm talking about a BPS guy, I have to put some scalars up there in the exponent. So here, phi, this guy is a scalar in the vector multiplet. And this angle theta tells me which supersymmetries are preserved. So in other words, these defects will come in a circle family labeled by theta. And this R tells you what kind of color source you put here. You can generalize this a lot. You can consider a Tuft lines, where you have some magnetic non-abelian source, and you can consider combinations of them. You can even define line defects in theories without Lagrangians. That's been studied a lot recently. OK, so that's the basic example and their symmetries. What kind of questions do we want to ask about them? OK, so throughout the talk, I'll let L will denote a defect, a line defect. And the defect L, you see, it's not really an operator because it extends in the time direction. It's a defect, meaning that you should think of it as a modification of space. So each defect L will support a Hilbert space. So this is the Hilbert space in the presence of L. And inside here is some subspace of BPS states. How are they defined? Well, there's a kind of modified BPS bound that exists when you have any line defect. So BPS states are defined by saying that they're particles whose, they're states whose mass is equal to the real part of their central charge times e to the I theta, where this theta is that theta. So states saturating this bound are called framed BPS states. They were introduced by Davide and Andy Knightsky and Greg Moore in the paper from a few years ago. How should you picture them? So what's the cartoon? Well, you can picture them roughly in the following way. There's some heavy core. And this heavy core particle is L. And then orbiting this in some kind of bound state are some light ordinary particles. This is sometimes referred to as the halo charge. So this is the physical picture. It's some kind of BPS hydrogen where you've got a proton here, which is taken to be infinitely massive, and you've got some electron orbiting it. And we, one of the basic questions one wants to ask is, given a defect L, what is its set of BPS states, set of protected states? And later we'll come back to see what to what extent this physical picture is accurate or misleading. Questions so far? No? Okay. Okay, so one of the basic questions we want to ask about any defect is, what is this framed BPS subspace? And another one that's interesting also is about the operator product expansion. So defects have an OPE. How does that go? Well, again, at the cartoon level, it's easy to see why this should be the case. If I have a defect here, L alpha, and this is time, and another one here, L beta, and I separate them by some delta z, so I've separated them in position in the z-axis. Now, this system with the two defects doesn't preserve all those symmetries that I wrote there. But if I take delta z to 0, then I get something where I collide them, which I could call L alpha, L beta, which does preserve those symmetries. So it has every right to be included in my list of all line defects. So you can make this a little sharper, or you can define what you mean a little better for BPS line defects. So we can look at the BPS subspace of this defect L alpha, and we can look at the BPS subspace of this defect L beta, and we can ask, what is the BPS subspace of this configuration where I have inserted both defects? Well, because of supersymmetry, this position is actually irrelevant here, this size of this position. So I can take delta z to be very, very large, and then by sort of usual clustering factorization arguments, this Hilbert space should become a tensor product. So that's what's on the left-hand side. On the other hand, I can take it to be very small, and then I'm supposed to get the Hilbert space of this guy. And I'd like to expand this guy in terms of other BPS defects. So there should be an expansion like this. That's what this picture motivates. And these things here are some OPE coefficients. Why do I put coefficients in quotation marks? And why did I write tensor here? The reason I did that is because this is actually a vector space. So one can get something that, I mean, this is the closest thing you can mean to an operator product expansion when you have defects. The coefficients have to be vector spaces. Is there a question?
I think it's likely that when delta z is finite, some instant effects will actually lift some pairs of states on the left hand side. Although, I mean, the Wittgenstein index of the left hand side and the right hand side will still be the same. Might be effects that go like e to the minus delta z mass of BPS electron. I can imagine some BPS particle splitting off L alpha and going to L beta.
Related to the networks you were drawing, yeah.
So I mean, the definition of the coefficients would still go through, but somehow on the left hand side, I need some, maybe the homology. The cohomology of that product is compared to some comp differential.
When delta z is infinite, do the these instantons don't contribute, right?
That's right.
Then it should really factorize.
That's right. As long as it's finite, even if it's very, very long,
they'll contribute.
You get a tiny lift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Fair point. I don't know. Well, that would be interesting to work out. I don't know how to.
So you can say it is an equation that holds in common, in Q cohomology.
Yeah, I mean, this equation, definitely the way I want to use it is in correlation functions with, you know, with operators that preserve the same supersymmetry.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then I guess it is true, yes. More questions, comments, corrections? Okay, so the moral of this story is that these ends here are some vector spaces, and they're the closest thing you could mean to OPE coefficients. You can get something that looks a little more like a usual algebra by defining some Witten indices of this sign. Let's see, is this thing obstructing people's view? People see over here?
Yeah.
Then this equation would be replaced gamma, a sum over gamma like this. So here gamma in both of these is running over all the line defects, all the simple line defects in technical language in my theory. And this is a kind of usual operator product expansion. It's meant to hold in correlation functions with operators that preserve the same supersymmetry as the original defects themselves. So this is all just to motivate the fact that defects have a kind of interesting algebra structure. And those C alpha beta gammas are something that we'd like to know. They're interesting coefficients. And moreover, they can be extracted from a knowledge of the BPS spectrum by the first equality there. So if I have computed the BPS spectrum, the frame BPS spectrum for every defect, I can extract the OPE coefficients using this kind of argument. Okay. So that's another thing that we're going to, general question that we're going to want to study. Any questions? OK, so now I'd like to start getting into techniques for how to actually address any of this. It's all been very abstract so far. So the main technique will be RGflow. And again, I'm reviewing work by Gayot and Wardnitsky here. So what will we do? We'll have our UV theory, some non-abelian gauge theory in general, or something more complicated even. And we're going to go to the Coulomb branch. So we're going to pick a vacuum U. And then we're going to end up with some IR theory, which is an abelian gauge theory. This is how we define the Coulomb branch, is such that this right-hand side is true. So if we start with a defect, line defect L in the ultraviolet, we could try and identify what it becomes in the infrared. So let me define what it becomes to be RGU of L. So RG means renormalization group, U means the particular vacuum, and L is the input here. Okay, what kind of thing is this? And why is it useful to do this? The reason that it's useful is that the physics here is extremely simple. It's an abelian gauge theory. So we can give complete answers to the question of what are the set of defects, what are the frame BPS spectra, what are their OPEs. And so if I can uncover this map, then I'll at least be some way towards answering my original questions. So in other words, the set of IR line defects as a set is just equal to the charge lattice. Well, what do I mean by that, and why is it true? I just mean that since this is an abelian gauge theory, the kind of line defects that you have are just Wilson and Tuft lines for an abelian gauge theory. And those are labeled completely by an electromagnetic charge. So we know where the image lies. It lies in this charge lattice. Okay. Now what are the properties? Well, once I say that, I can say a little bit more explicitly what this RG map is. How would I say physically what the image is? So physically, the image is, it's the charge of the lightest framed BPS state. I can put this in parentheses. So this is the map. This is what this is how an infrared observer would, to first approximation, describe this ultraviolet defect. He would just say, what is the charge of the ground state of this thing? That's how I'll think of it. Okay? And I put frame BPS in parentheses because it actually follows, because the frame BPS states are the lightest states. So this charge will be the charge of some frame BPS state, but it's actually the charge of the defect ground state. Okay. So this is the physical map. And it has a number of very miraculous conjectured properties, which can be proved in some cases. So what are the properties? So let's start with the less surprising and go to the more surprising. So first of all, this is well defined. What do we need for that? We need that the ground state, defect ground state, is generically unique. generically here means with respect to the vacuum. If I modify my position on the Coulomb branch, the energy of various states will change. And this may fail to be true at certain special loci, which we'll come to in a moment. But at the generic vacuum, the ground state is unique, and so this map will be well-defined. Okay. What about those special points? Let's draw a picture, actually. So let me draw a picture in the moduli space. I'll call this region U plus and U minus. So this is the moduli space here. And here is some locus where the ground state becomes degenerate. So at this point, exactly along this wall, there can be a jump in this RG map. And Gyota-Morinitsky conjectured a formula for this jump. Let me put minus subscript to indicate which side I'm on. Oops, sorry. So the discontinuity as you cross this locus is given by some interesting function, which is the max of okay, so in this formula, what is gamma? Gamma is a charge such that the real part of Z of gamma times e to the I theta is equal to 0. It's the primitive charge with that property. The existence of such a charge is what permits the ground state to be degenerate. This real part here is exactly what appeared in the BPS mass formula. So the ground state here and the ground state here differ by some multiple. Oh, sorry, this should be times the charge gamma. Differ by some multiple of gamma. And this formula here tells you which multiple it is. So this is a very interesting formula that tells you how the jumps occur. Okay. Finally, we'll come to the most interesting property. Are there questions about that formula? It can take a little bit of unraveling at first. So the final property, which I'd like to highlight, and this is really the punchline, is that RGU as a map from the set of UV defects to the set of IR defects is gamma, is generically bijective. Again, by generically, I mean at a generic point U. So this is really the meat, because what it says is that our program of trying to study line defects by figuring out how they behave under RG flow is really going to give us complete answers to questions about line defects by just inverting this map. So what's the evidence for this? So this statement, for example, is true in theories defined by two M5 brains on some Riemann surface sigma. That's some class of theories for which you can prove this statement. And in the rest of the talk, I'll exploit these properties to provide some calculational methods to answer the original questions we asked. What are the frame BPS states? What are the operator product expansions and so forth? Questions? No? Okay. Okay, so now we move on. So the method that I'm going to introduce now, using this RG map, is the method of quiver quantum mechanics. Okay, so we're going to use quiver quantum mechanics. And just to give you a little bit of background, quiver quantum mechanics is a very useful description for computing BPS states without defects. It's proven to be useful in that context. How does it work? So, and what is it? It's some non-relativistic description of BPS states. So, if you want to use quiver quantum mechanics, what you have to do is you have to identify some kind of BPS atoms. And these will be encoded by some nodes of a quiver diagram. Then there are some forces that these particles enjoy. And these will be represented by arrows. So what's the example that I'll come back to a lot? In SU2 super Yang Mills. So what are the BPS atoms? There are two of them. So there should be two nodes. This one you can think of as the monopole. And this one you can think of as the dion. And the forces between them are encoded by arrows. So there are two arrows. And these are, I should say, encoded by the Dirac pairing. So remember that if I write the electric and magnetic charges of this guy, I think I drew my arrows the wrong way for what I'm about to say. Sorry about that. This guy has charge 2 minus 1 in some conventions, and this guy has charge 0, 1. And those two arrows are just the symplectic product. So this is electric and magnetic charges that I'm writing here. Okay. And what else? So how are we supposed to use this diagram? So we're supposed to study. Okay, so if I want to find a bound state whose charges, so there's some integers here, and so particle number here. This will map to ranks at the nodes. So particle number is conserved because I'm trying to describe things in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So there'll be some integers here, n and m. And what am I supposed to do? Well, if I want to know if there's a BPS state whose charge is n times this guy and m times this guy, then I'm supposed to solve for the ground states of the n equals 4 quiver quantum mechanics with this diagram. So solve for supercharge quantum mechanics with the given quiver. Four supercharges because we're looking for a BPS state that preserves four supercharges. So that's a fast introduction to the way quivers work to describe ordinary BPS states. Let me make a couple comments about that. When is this picture physically justified? Let's try and disentangle that complicated question. We can always try and take the non-relativistic limit of our system. That's a reasonable thing to do. For example, well, but when is it going to give us a kind of weakly coupled quantum mechanics description? So it's physically justified at a wall of marginal stability. Why is that? Well, in this picture where I have two BPS atoms, let's call their central charges Z1 and Z2. And here's Z1 plus Z2. So at the wall of marginal stability, these things align. And when they align, the binding energy its absolute value is absolute value of Z1 plus absolute value of Z2 minus absolute value of the sum. And this is getting small when they align. So that means it's a reasonable physical thing to think of this particle with charge given as the sum of the two, as a bound state of the two individual constituents. That's what we physically can expect. But because of supersymmetry, it actually turns out that this picture can still applies even when this is not true. So in other words, once you have set up a quiver description, a quantum mechanics description of your BPS states, which you might derive by going near a wall of marginal stability, you can then move parameters away from that wall. And it's not too hard to show that, well, I guess I have to say the words Kontsevich-Soibelman wall crossing formula. But it is still true that the quiver description continues to describe the BPS states. And this is true even in very counterintuitive physical situations. For example, this same quiver can be used to describe the BPS states in SU2 super Yang Mills at very weak coupling. Now, that's a very bizarre description, because at very, very weak coupling, the W boson is extremely light. The monopole and dion carry magnetic charge and hence are parametrically heavy. Nevertheless, it's still possible to find the W boson as a bound state of these two extremely heavy things, even at very weak coupling. So this is where some black magic gets to happen, because I get to use this quantum mechanics description in regions of moduli space where you might naively think that it's not physically justified.
Okay, well, I think Kontsevich-Soibelman had proven recently a theorem that if there are masses, complex masses all say real, there is always at least one point, perhaps a unit point, in the Coulomb branch where all the central charges of the theory are real. Mm-hmm. So there is a place where they're essentially sitting close to marginal stability for all the particles.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So I guess physically it's reasonable that you can really have a quiver.
Yes, so you go there to say, there should be a quiver, yes. And then you move away, and because the BPS states that you get from this satisfy Kontsevich and Soibelman wall crossing formula, they sort of guaranteed that they are the correct description everywhere. But yeah, without that input of finding that locus where they align, you don't know whether it's going to work. More questions? Okay, so this was all for ordinary BPS states. This method is extremely useful for that. And now, what I'd like to do is extend it to describe these BPS states in the presence of line defects. I guess I'm supposed to go over here. Is that theorem of Kontsevich and Soderlund published?
I'm not sure the paper is out. I saw it talk.
Well, I mean, last March at Perimeter, Kontsevich gave a talk about it.
Yes.
But that was over a year ago. Or a year ago.
It doesn't.
I should say also, in relation to Davide's comment, I mean, the fact that that point exists where all the central charges align and this kind of argument takes over is very non-trivial in the sense that no one knows of such a point for general supergravities. For example, there's no reason, in fact it's not believed, that quivers describe all the BPS states in supergravity, and there is no point in general where all the central charges align. So somehow, because of the difference between field theory and supergravity, quiver quantum mechanics becomes much more powerful in field theory. Okay, so. Okay, so how are we going to extend this to framed BPS states? Well, there's really only one natural guess, and either that guess will work or it won't. So what's the natural guess? So we're going to add a new node, which will represent the defect. Right, we should have one new kind of thing to bind to in our quantum mechanics description. It should be infinitely heavy because it's a defect. So I should take the limit on central charges where the absolute value of this guy's central charge, this new node, goes to infinity, but the phase is fixed. In these conventions, the phase is actually e to the minus sine theta. So there's some very long ray in the central charge space. Okay, but how do I know what kind of node to add? So I mean, going back to our SU2 example, we have the monopole and the dion. We'll draw, say, a square node to represent L. And we know that its central charge should be very long. But what's the key physical input that will tell us how to connect these guys and what their quantum mechanical interactions are? That comes from the RG map. So the charge of L we define this to be RG U of L. So given that, I can draw arrows over here dictated by the Dirac pairing. So for example, if L is the Wilson line in the representation of dimension 1 plus n, or let's say k, then I'm supposed to draw k arrows like this. That would be the associated diagram. So for example, in the fundamental, there's just one arrow there. OK, so that's the proposed quiver. And then how am I supposed to get framed BPS states? Well, we extract framed BPS states which can be described as one L type of particle plus arbitrary other types. In other words, in specifying those particle numbers that I was talking about over there, I'm going to put a particle number of 1 on the node L and arbitrary on the other nodes. OK, so there is one subtlety here, which I can elaborate on sort of endlessly, but I'd like to get somewhere, so I'll maybe do that at the end if people are interested. When you quantize quiver quantum mechanics, you often find states with different physical descriptions. Some look like the core plus halo decomposition that I talked about before. Others look like they have multiple cores. And you can count the number of cores invariantly if you look at the wave function of this state in quantum mechanics. And so the major subtlety here is that if you really want to get the frame BPS states correctly, you should keep only states with one core plus a halo. So in other words, we actually, in order to get the correct spectrum out of the quiver, you have to enforce this physical picture that I drew before. Not all states that you extract from quantizing this quantum mechanics will have that description. So there is a subtlety there, and extracting them is technically complicated. But with that as a kind of big parentheses, this prescription for calculating the states actually works. Okay, so let me show you a kind of example result that you can produce from it. I should say again that fact that you have to keep only the states that look like one core and one halo, or and an arbitrary halo, is again slightly counterintuitive without knowing about the existence of the quiver. If I just told you abstractly that you were studying frame BPS states, you might think that, well, near a wall of marginal stability, the halo radius gets very large, the thing looks like it's about to decay, and the halo is about to become not bound to the core. But so that physical picture is justified there, but why should it be justified in other regions of moduli space? And that's, again, a kind of similar story to what I was talking about here, is that somehow the quiver forces you to consider only the states which always have that physical description. So it's a related remark to this binding energy observation. Okay. So what are some sample results? And what can we use this idea to prove? So sample results. So let's again stick to that example. And we'll look at Wilson lines, so that kind of quiver that I wrote up there. Let me define some symbol x sub gamma just as a bookkeeping device. So this gamma will be some charge in gamma, and this will be some formal variable to help me explain to you what all the states are, as I'll indicate in a minute. So the Wilson line in the trivial representation, what kind of states does it have? It has only the trivial uncharged state. And I'll denote that by just writing x sub 0, 0 here. The Wilson line in the fundamental, what kind of states does it have? Well, so again, gamma here will be a pair, electric, magnetic, like that. So this notation means that there's a state with electric charge minus 1, magnetic charge 0. A state with electric charge 1 and magnetic charge 0. This you should expect, what's here, from semi-classical analysis. After all, we started with an SU2 Wilson line, and we broke it to U1. So the 2 of SU2 does split into plus and minus 1 charge under the unbroken U1. But this is not all. You also find a state carrying some magnetic charge. So this is sort of non-perturbative. So there is a state, or which can be described as some kind of BPS particle orbiting the SU2 Wilson line, which carries some magnetic charge. And this you can get just by quantizing the quiver moduli spaces that come out of that. OK, let's do one more. And then I'll show you something. So what about the Wilson line in the adjoint? Well, again, you can split it into sort of an expected part and an unexpected part, or at least a part that you wouldn't be able to compute from semi-classical physics. So this is the part that just comes from taking the 3 of SU2 and decomposing it into a representation of U1. But then there are states carrying other charges. Let's get it right. So these 2s here now denote the fact that the states with these charges are actually carry spin. SO3 in the way. These guys with the 1 here were all in spinless multiplets. Okay, so what's the point in telling you such a detailed formula? I want to make good on my claim of showing you how to extract the operator product expansion from knowing the set of VPS states. So let's observe. We'll define these things x gamma such that x gamma 1, x gamma 2 is equal to x gamma 1 plus gamma 2. Then the tensor product that I told you about at the beginning to extract the operator product expansion can be done just by multiplying these things on the right. And you observe that W2 times W2 is equal to W1 plus W3. This is, of course, the correct OPE. After all, in the ultraviolet, the theory is weakly coupled. So we can examine the OPE just classically in the ultraviolet. And there, it's just supposed to be the representation algebra of SU2 representations. I just take 2 fundamentals and I collide them. And this is indeed the algebra there. So you can go on. We've done this to, until we both got kind of sick of it. I think we verified. We can't compute a closed formula for arbitrary k for the states directly. But we can see that for k through 7 or something, where these polynomials become, you know, many pages, that they do satisfy this rule. So that's the strong test of that what we're saying has some merit, and we get the expected operator product expansions. Okay, so that's a kind of sample formula, and then the final thing I want to tell you about is some general structure that follows from this picture. Are there questions about the sample formula?
If you replace these numbers with vector spaces, do you just get equality without cancellations? Or?
I didn't check that. So what I get. Okay, so what you mean if I replace them with the actual cohomology of the Kuiper moduli spaces, are they actually equal?
Yeah, in a sense, including the Fermi number.
Clearly,
the spin would work out. But.
And the no exotics conjecture is also true on the Kuiper moduli spaces. So, again, I get some positive. I don't know if this is answering your question, but if I include the spin dependence, I'll get some positive Laurent polynomials in the spin variable. So there aren't any cancellations when you multiply.
So it says perhaps my worry about the instant effects actually unfounded.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So, what kind of general things can you prove about line defects if you accept that our picture for how to compute them is true, at least in a theory where this picture works? What time did I start?
We're all 10 minutes.
OK, good. Well, let me briefly, there are two things, and I'll say one of them very briefly. So one is that you get a kind of explanation of the formula for RG plus minus RG minus, this kind of jumping formula. And, well, maybe an explanation is too much. It fits into a broader structure inside quiver quantum mechanics. And that broader structure is that there exist n equals 4 quantum mechanics Seiberg dualities. And these Seiberg dualities, in the language that I was using before to say physically what was happening, they have, in terms of a quiver, they mix up what I was calling BPS atoms with the kind of BPS molecule that is a general state in this description. So it changes what you were taught, which guy is viewed as a bound state for which guy is viewed as the fundamental constituent. And it's completely understood what kind of dualities exist. In fact, they can even be encoded graphically. So they're encoded by what's called quiver mutation. So how does that work? You mutate at a node. So let me give you an example mutation. So I'll start with this quiver, and I'll mutate here. And the rule is that I'm supposed to reverse all arrows. At the marked node, and add composite arrows. Well, let me do this first. I'll do the first step first. So the first step takes this quiver and sends it to this quiver. Then there's a second step, which is that you add composite arrows. Of length 2. Through the node marked with X. So here there's one length 2 composite arrow, which goes from here to here and then to here. So I should add an arrow to my resulting diagram like that. OK, so this is a graphical operation. You can do it on any node. And it actually encodes an action on the charge lattice, right? You remember each of these nodes in the description that I was giving you had some original charge. And the arrows were determined by their Dirac pairing. So you can work out what this transformation is on the charge lattice. And it turns out it's exactly the kind of transformation that appeared over here. So this stuff is exactly what is what goes into these kind of transformations. So you start to understand, and you can even work out more interesting pictures of why this formula was completely fixed, at least in theories where this description is valid, which is a large class. OK, so that's, I just want to give you some very telegraphic remarks about that. And then something more interesting will conclude the talk. Well, what am I doing? Just erase this. So the last interesting thing that you can prove is something that I'll call cones of line defects. So what I'm going to prove to you, or at least describe the result about, is that the set of all line defects has a kind of affine linear structure on it. So how does this work? So we're going to fix a vacuum U and a quiver description. Of the framed and unframed BPS states. So using RG, we identify UV defects with IR defects, which was gamma. Okay. Now we look at the set of defects L such that RG U of L Dirac product with gamma I, well, yes, is greater than or equal to 0, where gamma I is a node of the quiver. And we do this for all I. OK, so this is some subset of the space, set of all line defects. And it's conical, because if I scale up the RGU charge here this by a positive number, this, this constraint is still satisfied. So this is some cone. This defines a cone of line defects. What's special about this cone? What's special is that it's very easy to prove using the quiver description that this cone is a closed subalgebra of the set of the OPE algebra of all line defects. So if, let's call this cone C. So if I have L1 and L2 in C, then the OPE algebra of L1 times L2 is equal to RG inverse of U of RG, this is a fancy way of writing something very simple, U. So this is me, what am I saying? I'm just saying if you take the two defects labeled by their infrared charges and you multiply them, all that happens is you get the defect whose infrared charge is the sum of those two charges. That's exactly what would happen in an abelian gauge theory. In general, it doesn't happen for non-abelian defects, as was exemplified by this example here, right? The charge, so this is very special. It says that there's a closed subalgebra. And so that's one subalgebra, but actually there's more. Because of fact one that I'm erasing right now, you can in fact find many distinct cones by using various different Seiberg dualities. And so what you get is a partition of the set of line defects into a bunch of non-overlapping subalgebras. So using quiver mutation, we can find many such cones. So let's draw the picture for SU2, and then I'll conclude. So for SU2, so this will be the electric charge axis, and this will be the magnetic charge axis. And here I'm drawing gamma. By the first bullet point over there, I can identify gamma with the set of ultraviolet defects. So this is a, you can think of this as a picture in the set of ultraviolet defects using some coordinates. OK, so what's true about it? So the first cone, well, that you find is something like this. So there's some cone of defects here. These are Tuft-Wilson lines, because that's the general defect in SU2. Then there are more cones. So let me draw all of them. These cones have the feature that they only intersect on their boundaries. And moreover, although these cones look very simple, as I move towards the purely electric charge axis, the cones begin to get narrower and narrower, and they actually accumulate. So there's an infinite number of cones here. And the same thing is true down here. The cones accumulate, and they accumulate up against the electric charge axis. So this green ray is not in any cone. But aside from those defects here, and what are the defects that are on this ray? The defects that are on this ray are just Wilson lines. So this guy here is W2 that we studied up there, then there's W3, et cetera. Here was W0, or W1 in the notation that I was using before. So aside from the purely electric Wilson lines, all other defects are in some particular cone, and their OP algebra, at least with other guys in this cone, in their cone, obeys this simple additive property. On the more general ray here, it's more complicated. So this is a structure that you can easily prove exists, given the picture. You can try and work it out for what it is for SU3 or more complicated theories, and you get some interesting structure. I don't know where it abstractly comes from, but it seems useful to know that there are all these subalgebras of the set of line defects. So let me conclude by highlighting a couple open questions.
Somehow the all these half lines for each of the UV H groups?
It's more complicated because actually, so there are sort of three levels of complexity in the cones that can happen. So the first, this is an intermediate case. The simplest case is something that occurs, say, in Argyros-Douglas theories, where there are a finite number of cones that cover the entire charge lattice. And so every UV defect is in some cone. The next level up in complexity is what occurs here. This will occur in the A1 theories of class S in general. There will be rays, if you like, or non-open sets in the charge lattice that are not in any cone. And so, I think for every SU2 gauge group, you'll get one such. And then the final level of complexity is what occurs in more general, say, SU3 and higher gauge theory, which is that there'll be a whole open set which is in no cone at all. So there'll be some wedge, for example. And the cones will these cones that I drew here will accumulate against two things that don't meet. And there's just a whole open set in the set of line defects that's in no cone. That makes it very hard to describe the OPE algebra of those things. I mean, the real great feature of these cones is that, suppose I wanted to describe to you in simple terms what is the operator product algebra of line defects, it suffices to pick a generator on the boundary of each cone and tell you the relations among those. And because of the general properties of the algebras that I said, that will give you the entire list. But so for here, you'd have to pick you'd have to talk about all the Wilson lines. The Wilson lines obey these kind of rules for SU2, and all the generators on the boundary. But for, say, SU3, you have to talk about every line defect in that wedge individually, which is very tricky.
So the generators on boundaries are two operators of charge 1 and generic electric charge? Or
sorry, can you?
In the SU2 gauge theory, are there generators on the boundary, two operators of, say, charge 1 and any electric charge? Or
Their description.
I guess it's not easy.
I'm not sure. I never worked it out. But yeah, it would be really interesting to figure out why, from some more deep principle, this structure exists. I mean, it's hinting at something, but I don't know what. So that was one of my concluding questions that I think are interesting. So what are these cones of algebras good for? I mean, there certainly are some structure on the set of line defects, but why it's there, I don't know. A second thing is kind of computation. What is the OPE algebra for interesting theories that we care about, say SUN super Yang Mills? I've given you the technology to compute it, but no one has done it, and it would be interesting to understand what it is and what its structure is. And finally, this is a little more wild, but I still think it's interesting. How can we generalize this to surface defects? Right, in the study of BPS states, there's been a geometric method pursued by Gyota Mornaitsky, and they found that, you know, there's ordinary BPS states, BPS states bound to line defects, BPS states bound to surface defects and combinations. And so far, quivers can only keep up on the ones that sort of intrinsically are described in terms of particles or very heavy particles, like the examples that I've told you here. But I'm suspicious that perhaps there does exist a generalization to describing surface defects, but it would be really fun to work that out. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Let's thank our speaker. Questions?
Just a question. Which superpotential do you put there? Just one in each phase?
The thing that we did was to put the generic superpotential. So if you, there's a notion in quivers of generic superpotential, which is just what it sounds like. Just, you know, put the leading cubic terms, and if basically assume that all terms that can exist generically do exist. If you relax that, you get things that are way wrong. So we at least tested that in this case.
And so suppose someone just gives me a black box that computes the Euler character of this quiver, quantum mechanics. So how do I distinguish the one core?
That's a really interesting question. So this is the major subtlety. So the way that works is, okay, quiver quantum mechanics, you get it by dimensionally reducing from n equals 1 gauge theory with the same quiver. And you know that that moduli space has two branches, a Higgs branch and a Coulomb branch. Okay. So in fact, when people talk about quantizing quiver moduli spaces, it's actually ambiguous what they're talking about. Are they talking about quantizing the Coulomb branch or the Higgs branch, and why should they agree? Mm-hmm. There's some very famous work by Frederick Dunef about this question. And so the picture that I just told you, the physical picture, where you really think of these guys as some kind of atoms with some position and they form bound states, that's the description of the Coulomb branch. Right? In the Coulomb branch, and then there's another description which is computationally easier, which is on the Higgs branch. And in general, the BPS states extracted by quantizing the two moduli spaces do not agree and have no reason to agree. The one which gives the physically correct answer is the Coulomb branch. And on the Coulomb branch, it's easy to see this because literally you have a wave functions in position, so you can sort of tune to wall of marginal stability, and if you do that, there's for a single core guy, there's sort of the whole size of the wave function gets larger. If it's multi-core, the whole size will not get larger. There'll be some kind of little bubbles that will kind of stay isolated from each other. So it is possible. And in fact, Ashok Sen and Boris Piolin and Jan Menschow introduced a formula to basically calculate exactly these states. So
you told the results of the black box into the formula and extract what you want?
Yeah. But the reason that's a major subtlety for us is that if you go in and you say, well, I'll just take this quiver with the generic superpotential and I'll quantize the Higgs branch, which is what people, including myself, were doing for years, you will get the wrong answer for the frame BPS states. So you have to actually know where the picture is physically justified, but yeah.
So So with same formula, can you show that these prescriptions have behaves well under what costing?
His formula actually satisfies KS. That was one of the main results that they proved, is that their formula satisfies the wall crossing.
So if you apply it to your problem,
it will also satisfy. Yeah.
Other questions? If not, let's think like it.